Yeah, the topic I had in mind for tonight was some reflections on the Four Noble Truths, particularly some reflections on practicing with the Four Noble Truths. And actually, I was inspired by the Friends literature that's just outside the door. Has anyone stopped and read this stuff? It's great. And there was something. There's a flow chart. There's a decision chart about when to speak and when to not speak at friends meetings. Friends meetings that sit in a circle in silence, and then someone's moved to speak, and they have this apparently a questionnaire that they go through of like, should I speak or should I not? And one of them is it intellectual or is it like arising out of something deeper? And then is it for the whole community or is it just like coming from the intellect? I'm sorry, for the whole community, or is it something like ego driven? Anyway, I loved that, and I was sitting here like minute after minute would go by in the sitting, and I was just like, let's just bask in the silence of the Buddha Dharma. It didn't need anything more than that. Anyway, I'm very touched by all this. So the Four Noble Truths. I'm sure we'll weave in the friends' methods one way or another into the talk, but how are folks' level of familiarity with the Four Noble Truths? It's talked about pretty recently, sort of a central framework in Buddhist teaching. One of the reasons that I like to reflect on it is that it can kind of be a summary that holds everything in Buddha Dharma. If you try and take a little dance step here and there, you can connect pretty much everything to the Four Noble Truths. The profundity of them is apparent when we look at teachings that link awakening to the Four Noble Truths. Things like some pretty emphatic things are said in some of the suttas, like if anyone has ever awakened to things as they are, they have awakened to the Four Noble Truths. So they go deep. But not only that, I feel like just the way they go deep, they also go quite wide. And there's an applicability to the Four Noble Truths that I think will become evident as we talk. But I love them because you can use them as a framework in so many situations in our life. So what are we talking about here? Four Noble Truths. In brief, the first noble truth is that of suffering. There is suffering in this life. We'll get into that in some detail. The second is that suffering arises based on conditions or causes, which is strangely linked to some really good news that I'll get into. The third noble truth is the explicit good news that there's an end to suffering. And then the fourth noble truth is the way to the end. So everything sort of revolves around suffering or dukkha, its arising, its cessation, and then how to get to its end. The Dharma in a nutshell. So one of the ways that I like to enter into thinking about the Four Noble Truths and reflecting on them is actually with a little bit of a visualization. So you're welcome to close your eyes if you like. This is a visualization inspired by one of the classic Buddhist metaphors of an ancient path. So if you like, you can imagine yourself walking in a forest, just slow and easeful. And you find that this forest has grown over. It's getting kind of dense with brush and shrubs and grasses. And things get so thick that you don't know how to proceed. You don't know where to step. So you stop. Stand still with your senses open. And suddenly, with these open senses, you see, you know, or you sense, this is the way forward. You can see a little opening. Take a step, and then you're back on the path. So in this visualization, and you're welcome to open your eyes, it's so simple. There's a way that our life in the Dharma, or our relationship to Buddhist practice, is likened to a path. And certainly there are going to be these times when we come up against density and shrubbery and thorns and friction and challenge. That's all of us. And thankfully we have a practice like this, where we study, like we're students of stillness and silence. And somehow that nourishes our sensitivity, our knowledge about how to proceed, we know our way forward. And the freedom that comes from that is just as palpable as like an open path right in front of us. In a way, it's kind of the Four Noble Truths in a nutshell. So I suppose we can liken dukkha, suffering, to that like overgrown thorny shrub. One of the other classic metaphors for this is dukkha in the text apparently is likened to like a wheel that's out of kilter. Have anyone heard this metaphor before? Like the axle is just a little bit off, so that when the wheel turns, it goes dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. Isn't that great? Yeah. So this is just a little bit off can be one form of dukkha. That's just pervasive, actually. But the Buddha does something really interesting with this term. You can see it as like an umbrella term that includes that just a little bit off, and then everything in between, all the way to the most profound suffering that we have in our lives, including existential suffering and the challenges of our own death, or death of our dear ones. It's defined this way in the text, just so you hear it. What is the noble truth of dukkha, of suffering and stress? And here, what a range is included. Birth is stressful, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five aggregates of clinging are stressful. In colloquial terms, I really like the summary of not getting what we want. Not getting what I want. Dang! So sometimes if we dwell on the dukkha aspect of the Buddhist teaching, you might hear occasionally someone say, "Oh, I don't like Buddha Dharma. That's too pessimistic. Too pessimistic. Suffering. No, thank you." But the teaching of dukkha, we say it comes along with the path. It comes along with the promise of the end of suffering. It can be quite inspiring. So that's quite a spread about the First Noble Truth. What I want to say about it, in terms of practicing with the First Noble Truth, is that each of the truths has an associated task or a practice. And the First Noble Truth has its task of, in relationship to dukkha, our task is to understand, to comprehend. And not just intellectually, but there's something where an understanding goes beyond the words, beyond our reflection, into our cultivated being. All three of these layers, actually. They talk about three layers of understanding in the commentaries. We can develop our understanding by hearing, by reflecting, and then by cultivation. But for this understanding of dukkha to be freeing, it's got to go really deep in there. We really have to be able, and the way we do this is through observation, a deep observation. So the practice associated with the First Noble Truth is understanding. And then we really get into the dynamics of the Four Noble Truths when we move into the practice with the second. The practice associated with the second noble truth is letting go, abandoning. The Thai forest monks talk about the core issue is attachment. In our Western psychological vocabulary, this gets into some complicated territory to talk about attachments. But really, there's this great metaphor, I don't know where this comes from, of rope burn that illustrates how suffering happens. And it's like if you try to take in your hand the rope and you grip it, you hold on to it, you cling to it, but your grip isn't strong enough to hold the rope still, so it pulls through your hands. The more you grip, the more it burns. And then if you can just let go, then the friction isn't there anymore. One of the tricks of this is that there are some occasions when we can do the letting go, and there are occasions where it can't, like we just have to be patient, actually. Some occasions are like the hot stove. It's just natural to move the hand back. And other forms of suffering just seem to hang around like our best friends for life. So how do we do that in an artful way? So you hear the text version. What's this noble truth, the origin of suffering? It's the craving that leads to further becoming. That's a sort of technical term that is related to the way we make a self out of our experience. So it's a certain kind of grabbing onto the rope that causes us trouble. Some of the things I really want to say about this second noble truth is that it was like a light bulb for me when I realized that dukkha was not a sin, or it wasn't an indication that I was messing something up. Like I'm not bad and I'm not wrong because I suffer. So what that did for me was like lighten the tendency to want to shame, or like want to put myself down because something is difficult in my life. Like I'm going to lose loved ones. Like I'm gonna get sick. I'm gonna age. Like there's nothing. I didn't do anything wrong. So if there's any like extra compounding the necessary suffering of our lives with this extra layer of like, ah, I'm so terrible, and that's why suffering is happening. It may not need to be there. The way that the second noble truth is sort of good news is because dukkha arises dependent on conditions. Good news is not obvious yet. Dukkha arising dependent on conditions, that means if you remove the conditions, then the dukkha falls apart. It's like a house of cards. And if you take the bottom layer out, everything falls. Everything's like this. Everything that we can experience, it arises based on conditions. That means it's bound to cease, dukkha included. That's the good news. People don't usually characterize the second noble truth as good news, so I want to acknowledge that I'm taking some liberty with that. But knowing that dukkha is conditioned, that's promising. Any particular instance of dukkha is bound to end, and we can have a role in its falling apart. And one of the ways we do this is we become, I said earlier, we become students of stillness and silence. We also become students of dukkha. If dukkha is not exactly a sin, like it's not saying, oh, you're bad for suffering. Dukkha is saying, like, look here. It hurts here. Look here. Get to like really get to know this. Gil, I don't know which way he is, says, if you want to be free, study where you get stuck. So, maybe a caveat to this is in mindfulness practice, we're studying the conditions that are holding up dukkha in the present moment. So it doesn't have to be an archaeological dig for that particular aspect of the practice, but here in this moment, how is this experience of dukkha coming? How's it going? And is there anything I'm doing that's keeping it in place? And you can see if you can let go. So the third practice, the third noble truth, the explicit good news of the cessation of suffering. I like to turn this practice into the form of a question, which is you can drop this into your own meditation or just take it up at any time. And the question is, where am I free? Where's freedom now? I think one of the reasons that this is it's a useful question is that a little taste of freedom, or a hint of freedom, or a modicum of freedom points the way for us. It's like in the thick jungle, sensing where just where that next step forward is, the next opening. The complete cessation of dukkha we call nibbana, and it's like the going out of a flame. So the heat has finally subsided. And the way that a little bit, a little hint, a little modicum of freedom points the way. Guy Armstrong has this great metaphor of a bread factory. Has anyone ever driven near a bread factory? No? Yeah. You get close enough and you start to smell it. And then you know, and then you drive a little further and the smell gets stronger. And you go, oh, the bread factory is that way. And you keep going. And the further you go, the stronger it gets. Ah, there it is. So just follow the scent is his punchline. It's like, follow the scent of freedom. If you can ask yourself in this moment, where am I free? Where's the freedom here? Even in the midst of challenge. And it's not really to fake ourselves out. You know, if there's a real challenge going on, it's not to say, oh, this challenge isn't happening. Where's the freedom? But there is a way somehow that both of these can live together. There can be deep challenge and a hint toward, okay, what's the next wholesome step? What's the next wholesome step? They say that the task or the practice of the third noble truth is that it's to be realized. So the first noble truth is understood, the second is we let go, and the third we realize freedom. I'm saying we're students of everything, apparently. In the third noble truth, we're students of awakening. We're students of freedom. We're students of non-suffering. In the Zen ordination ceremonies, they say, from now on, awakening is your teacher. All beings are your teacher. And thinking of that in an insight context, sometimes when I meet people for practice discussion, and I always have this sense of sort of wonder at the depth of a human life. And there may be a way that there's this deep suffering being shared, but I also it's like a sparkle in their eye, or like some there's a some kind of subtle indicator that there's beauty and happiness that's also here. It's really something to see. Yeah. So all beings become our teachers when we look around and we see how is this being free? How is this being free? Maybe one other thing I'd like to say about the third noble truth. Is that the in just the same way that the Buddhist teaching on dukkha indicates this very broad, sort of pervasive difficulty. Not to say all things are suffering, but like there are many, many forms of suffering, covers a lot of territory. Similar in scope is the promise of the ending of dukkha. There's a in the texts, in the teachings, there's this really radical possibility of the complete ending of suffering in a human life. The metaphor is like a cut off palm stump that won't arise again. The tree won't arise again out of the stump. This tends to raise a question for me, which is, that doesn't look like my life. Radical ending of suffering. So the difficulty, or maybe I'll say the art is there a way to stay inspired by a radical freedom It's also honest about our actual practice. It's maybe a little bit of a nuance, but something I wanted to state as we're here on the third noble truth. What are the ways we can stay encouraged and inspired and excited, and how do we support each other? I think Sangha is one of the most important ways. A community is one of the most important ways. There were mornings at Tassajara when it was 15 degrees and I'm not allowed to wear socks in the meditation hall, and like, I don't want to get out of bed this morning, but I know, well, I know someone's going to come knock on my door. But even if they weren't, I noticed any day that I didn't go, something felt off. Something felt off. It's like I'm just a little out of connection, just a teensy bit. The inverse of that is the way that all of us being there together supported each other. I think that's one of the great gifts of a community like this. So where am I free now? Then in relationship to the fourth noble truth, we could spend, what did you say? IMS Book Club is 6 months. We could definitely spend 6 months on the four noble truths, but I think we'll say I'm going to spend 3 minutes on the fourth noble truth. The path of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. Actually, because there's so much good stuff about that, I'm going to say two things. One is the importance of learning about each of the factors and the importance of right view. Right view. If you don't know where you're going, you might end up somewhere else. Right view is like the cultivation of vision that recognizes this is the path, this is the way forward. Explicitly one of the ways that right view is cultivated is by considering your experience in terms of the Four Noble Truths, recognizing in your own experience, suffering is suffering. Non-suffering is non-suffering. This is a movement toward it. This is a movement away. Like really getting into this. And one of the others is recognizing that our actions have an effect in the world, that we have agency. Second thing in my last minutes on the fourth noble truth, this Noble Eightfold Path is the content of the fourth noble truth. And I made up this metaphor so I could remember it. So I could remember the eight of them. Some of you may have heard me do this before, but I love it so much. I'm happy to share again. But finding the eight factors on the body. So right view is like the eyes. Right view, right intention, this little thinking cap, speech, obviously, action and livelihood. I made the right and left hand. So all the things we do with our hands. View, right intention, right speech, action, livelihood, right effort. I liken to the tummy, where our belly, where our power comes from, our core, right effort. Then right mindfulness, I liken to the whole sensing, maybe the skin, maybe all the nerves, the whole thing. Mindfulness, right effort, right mindfulness. Concentration is this. In the Thai forest teachings, they talk about the when a mind gets concentrated, they say that the citta gets concentrated, and that word is both the mind and the heart. So concentration. So view, intention, speech, action and livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. Thank you for hearing my metaphor. The action for the fourth noble truth is it is to be developed. It is to be cultivated. Yeah, there's so much beautiful ground to cover in the four noble truths. I understand that May talked about the four noble truths in a particular way when she was with you. And gosh, it's only just scratching the surface. There's so much good stuff. I hope you spend some time with it if you haven't. So may this be a commercial for the Four Noble Truths. And I alluded to this a little bit, but one of the ways more meaningful than to describe what freedom might be like, one of the ways to sense your way into it actually is to become a really close student of dukkha, become a really close student of suffering, so that you know it when it's there, and then you know it when it's not. So with that recognition of, oh, there's an absence of dukkha here, that's the flavor of freedom that that further develops. There is a strata of pain and unpleasant experience that will always be with us as part of a human life. Like, even the Buddha got a backache. And there's this extra layer of pain that for most of us, it just keeps on happening, but it's not guaranteed. And the extent to which I guess we become adept at letting go of attachment, that layer of pain diminishes. So there will be this strata of challenges in our life, that's for sure. Whether it's arthritis or saying goodbye. And then that kind of difficulty that comes from our clinging, that can be let go. Sometimes I think about when we sit in our meditation posture, and I don't know how you sit with your hands. Sometimes I sit with mine up, sometimes I sit with them down. Sometimes when I sit with them up, and I've got this big circle, my arms to my hands, it's big enough to hold my whole heart. Just gently. And then the shape and the temperature and the velocity of grief will shift. I mean, it's so dynamic. And it has its own process and its own way of teaching us. Thanks so much. Thanks for the time together.